and try to make me a happy home.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. You are listening to Love in the 21st Century, a talk show to discuss the philosophical to the practical look of love, from romantic relationships to connections with humanity. One-third dating insights, one-third self-love guide, one-third compassion training. Tonight, myself, Tamara, and Adam Mose are hosting the show, and we are going to continue on our conversation about love and family. If you'd like to join the conversation, feel free to give us a call at 895-1114.
Love is but a song we sing. Fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing and you turns for us at last. We are but a moment's sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together.
Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by the one of Chico's newest restaurants, Rollo's West, at 234 West 3rd Street in the heart of downtown. Rollo's West offers small and large plates, Maryland-style shrimp, blue crab cakes, a wine bar, charcuterie, and artisanal cheeses. Rollo's West is open from 5 till 9 p.m. until 10 on Friday and Saturday. For more information, visit them on Facebook or by calling 636-4468.
If you hear the song I sing, you will understand. Listen. You hold the key to love and fear, all in your trembling hand. Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your command. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Smile on your brother, everybody.
to get together. And we're talking about love and the family. And we understand that everyone is an expert in love and family because we're all born of love. And we all have some type of family of origin and eventually, hopefully, like a family of our own creation. This is what we're looking at and what we're in making our inquiry into along these lines from the point of view of the Dharma. This is my orientation and something that I found very helpful in being in family and being in community. And want to share some of these insights and practices with you all, and love to hear your feedback as well, your discoveries and your challenges. This is all part of the conversation. One initial way to kind of kick it off is thinking about the family structure, the family of origin, and how that's changing, that's evolving. From earlier generations, there was a great deal of emphasis like on authoritarian family. There was the head of the family, they call the shots. And, you know, we all have to follow along. And new models of familial structures emerge, like as the culture evolves, basically, where everything is more collaborative and egalitarian. There's a consensus with all the voices of the members of the family being able to contribute to the direction that the choices that affect the whole family are going to take. And if we didn't get that in our family of origin, if that wasn't modeled for us, then it's something that we can develop. We can get some practice in. And then it's something that, this is the idea that each family's, the generations, build on the subsequent ones. We get to make our own mistakes. You know, we don't have to make the mistakes that necessarily our parents made in raising us. So it's not like there isn't going to be any mistakes in this amazing, you know, complex karmic connection that is family. But they're honest learning mistakes. You know, that isn't just the old repetition, the old habit.
Yeah, I think that it's that we are blessed with the perspective of seeing those challenges or lessons that our parents learned so that we may not make those mistakes in the future, mm-hmm. if that's what we choose to do. Mm-hmm. However, in that process, we make our own new, unique mistakes.
Yeah, and our own unique accomplishments.
Right.
You know, what we've been able to take it further. And the idea is that every generation, it gets a little bit more closer to this ideal of a more unconditional love. That the love, from the Dharma point of view, we have this idea of the working definition of love being the genuine interest and activity of creating happiness for the other, wanting the other happiness, and then going ahead and providing what you believe will give that, facilitate, help them discover that. There's this idea, oh, you can't make somebody happy. Mm-hmm. You know, even if they say Disneyland is the happiest place on earth, you could still go there and have a miserable time.
Very true.
Depending on your state of mind. But you're more likely to have a good time there than, say, Leavenworth, Kansas.
I don't know what's much there, so I'm going to go ahead and say yes.
Not much there.
Yeah.
But the opposite is true. You could be in Leavenworth, Kansas, and be having a great time. It depends on your state of mind, you know, the type of happiness that you have in a place. Okay, that's another dharmic principle. The other key point, you know, philosophically, in really generating the unconditional love is, from the dharmic point of view, a mind can never be wasted. They say, oh, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. But minds are recycled. Bodies come and go in this point of view. Like a driver and a car. You know, you've had a couple cars. If you've owned a car, you've had an old car. It was conking out or whatever. You had time to let it go. You sold it. Got a new car. You know, so the driver continues. The car's gone elsewhere. Similar with a body. That's the idea in the Dharma. We're saying we don't know exactly, you know, because I don't even remember what I had for lunch 3 months ago. How could I remember what I was doing in my past life? But in nature, everything is conserved and everything goes in circles. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest. And it just for a, if we just hypothetically hold it loosely, the idea of rebirth, then if there's been one rebirth, there's been like a dozen. If there's been a dozen rebirths, then hundreds. If there's been hundreds of rebirths, there's been thousands, hundreds of thousands. We can't find the origin of a mind because it's unoriginated. So there's limitless births. This is part of the philosophical vision. But it leads to this recognition that in all of these rebirths, there's been mother, father who raised that being, you know, who was this mind stream previously.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave tender care, they nurtured, and now in this life, they've been reborn as some passerby on the street. But in a past life, they were close, they were relations. This relates to the Native American saying, oh, all my relations. Native American is this feeling that all of nature is part of a family, that there's people who are not human people, but are living and have a mind that continues, and we're part of this huge family. So in this life, it looks like there's a certain situation where, you know, I'm separate from some people, I'm apart from other people. Other people are even, you know, made out to be an enemy. I'm told to really be scared or apprehensive of refugees from Syria, for instance. But in a past life, this was a mother, this was a father, you know, so if I'm thinking that way, then I'm not as likely to exclude them from my love. So that capacity for loving unconditionally starts to kick in and enriches any situation, every situation. You know, if we can see that there's brothers and sisters all together here, and this is my first discovery in like alternate family making. I went to the Rainbow Family, and as soon as you arrive there, everyone says, welcome home. You're like, oh, okay, I'm in the middle of the woods, there's all these crazy hippies around me, but it feels like home, because everyone's, you know, caring about each other and taking care of each other. And it just so happens, my wife had gone to a rainbow gathering and she had a similar experience, a revelation. She's like, if I ever meet a guy, he's going to have to know about this part of my life. little did she know, I was at that gathering, you know. So it worked out. But many, many stories, many, many paths.
Could you maybe explain a little bit more for our listeners what the Rainbow Family is?
Yeah, it is an experiment in spontaneous community, I guess, or it's difficult to explain. It's a non-organization that gets together every summer. They've gotten together every summer since the summer after Woodstock. It was kind of like Woodstock, but without the electrified music. You know, it's like if we went off in the woods and made our own music and took care of everybody, what would that feel like? How could we organize that? And there were some amazing visionaries, you know, who wrote about how to have a healthy, safe gathering, make sure everyone gets fed, do the sanitation, and clean up like 100%. Everything disappears, we leave the site, you know, better than we found it. That was the initial vision. It's gone through some permutations over the years. You can go online to welcomehome.org. Amazing website, like one of the very first websites on the internet. It was made by this beautiful Rainbow tech pioneer, Rainbow Rob, a Radio Rob. He does the radio communications at the gatherings. But welcomehome.org has a lot of the old songs and the information about where the gathering's going to be. So it's still going. It's still going strong. But the experiment was there for me to get out of my comfort zone of what I knew to be family and to really put into practice loving the guy, the random guy in the woods, you know, I've never met before, as a brother, you know. But then they were doing the same thing. They were coming in the direction from their side too. So it was easy. It got easier. And it's not for everybody. It's hardcore camping. You know, you're like out in the woods, and they try to make it accessible. There's like an accessibility camp. There's no alcohol allowed, like in the main gathering. There's no rules. It's like a complete cooperative. You know, we're all just agreeing upon these things. But like we make an A camp, like out towards the parking lot where folks can drink, but the regular majority of the site. And the central part of it is this prayer for peace on July 4th, Declaration of Interdependence, our Interdependence Day. From sunrise until noon on that day, it's all silent. And we just gather in the main meadow, pray, hold the space, meditate for world peace. And it's very amazing. That's a very different phenomena. You know, just people holding the space and being quiet on the ground. Then there's an om that breaks the silence. The kids' parade comes from Kidsville. And it's like, yes, world peace has erupted once more. We're the happy tribe living on the land, and it's a healing.
Sounds pretty divine. To draw the connection to what you were speaking about earlier in terms of seeing the people in community, or as you mentioned, Syria earlier, as this kind of eternal brother and sister, and connecting it to the Dharma, that in some way or form, you know, we share the interconnection. Do you feel that in the social experiment of being a part of Rainbow, it was or is easier to see that in people as your brother and sister than it might be in your everyday life, you know, behind somebody in traffic?
Absolutely. Yeah. You got to intentionally rehumanize yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And however it is that you find how to do that, just walking in nature, that's the one of the beautiful things. The rainbow happens out in National Forest. And we're usually up there in just this beautiful, pristine wilderness. And you get a healing from just being that far out in nature with a tribe. It feels like, wow, you know, bodily. This is something we've been doing for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Gather around the fire at night, tell stories, sing songs, play drums, dance around. It's like what we've been doing for a long, long time. And it is the majority of the human experience was celebrated that way. So the Burning Man Festival, all of the music festivals, they start to get a feel of it. For instance, like I went to, was it Transcendence Festival in Sacramento a couple of years ago, and there was some problem with the permit, and they pulled the plug, you know, like at 11 o'clock or something. They said no more amplified music. So all the stages went off. And the crowd kept on going. We just grabbed drums. We started to get around and play music. And then it was like, oh, this is what felt even better. The music was great. Everyone was dancing to the electronica. But then it's the what the crowd does together and the vibe, you know, of seeing one another as brothers and sisters. And however it is, you can find how to reconnect with that. That's something that will facilitate your approach to a genuine unconditional love.
If you're just tuning in, this is Love in the 21st Century. You're listening to 90.1 FM. Adam Mose and myself, Tamara, are talking about love and family and weaving in some Dharma as well.
And we were talking also about this idea of going from our family of origin to the family of our own creation, co-creation. And this was a big, long arc for me personally. Oddly, I kind of knew I always wanted to have kids. When I was young, even, I was like, oh yeah, when I get older, that'll be something beautiful to do. But how to get to the point where it goes from relationship to partnership, I never really considered. What's the difference? What's the difference between relationship and partnership?
I'm intrigued.
Okay.
What is it?
It's a simple one. It might be different for different people too. But for me, symbolically, it was vows. And vows is something spiritual. It's like a little decision, a little commitment you make to yourself and you keep it. And this comes from the Dharma as well, where they say, if you make a vow and you keep it, it starts to build power. It like changes you on a molecular level.
Powerful.
Yeah. So in cultures around the world, the marriage thing is seen as like, oh, you've made some commitment. There's been some sacred bond, you know, that demarcates your earlier life from this life. You know, you are not in a partnership, now you're in a partnership. My particular one wasn't till death do you part. We had a beautiful vows that were given to me by a dear spiritual friend of mine that were very unique in that they were poetic and like expansive. You know, they felt like you're not getting roped into something. You're not getting tied down. It had that potential. Like he said, one of the lines in there is, "In loving, let there be no grasping." And the sum total of all of the activities, you know, the practices that I've been doing, if I could just get that one, you know, it's like a simple line. It's part of it. But to be genuinely loving without the ownership field, you know, I love you because you're this for me.
Right.
Is the challenge.
And then how does that weave into what you're explaining about relationship versus partnership and that commitment? So the commitment to be present to somebody in your partnership, regardless of, you know, the grasping concept, which is, you know, what a lot of our kind of, you know, United States philosophy around marriage is, that once you're married, there's a sense of ownership in your marriage. So if removing that part, then to still have the partnership, I'm imagining that the other vows within that, or the vows to oneself of how they want to be in relationship, are quite valid and important to look at.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was part of a whole care package. This was the neat thing. The vows were called the efforts towards harmony. That, you know, from the Dharma, perspective of the Dharma, we're all like works in progress. We're this, you know, a continuum of evolution. And there's parts that you might be more freed up in that I'm still not. You know, I still am going to make some mistakes in those departments. And there's areas where you're freed up. That's no longer a problem. Or you're still hooked up. That's no longer a problem for me. So it's in the Dharma, it's called samsara. There's something defunct about the general it's going to happen. Suffering is going to happen. We're going to bump into, people are going to do really silly things. And so, forgiveness and forbearance, this idea, comes to the fore. So we need to put forth an effort on my side. In the partnership, it's a line. You know, there's like a line. The men are on one side, the women are on the other. The men are working on themselves. They're developing and growing. The women have that option to do that as well. Then when we meet, there's less friction. There's a possibility of more genuine intimacy. And both dual cultivation, where I'm working on myself from my side, she's working on herself. And then there's some possibility, there's some growth potential. So the efforts towards harmony was the whole care package that my dear friend gave to me. He was checking out when I first met him. He was already getting ready to finish that body. And one of the testaments to his spiritual advancement was how more relaxed and loving he got about it, the more his body was falling apart and falling apart. Mm-hmm. He just had more time for others, more focus on helping others. very beautiful character named Fritz. If that was his name. It probably wasn't. He had a lot of different names. But he gave me this little package, and included in the package was this little bombshell called the 6-in-1. Very, very simple, very innocuous. We've talked about it before.
Definitely.
But that's like he saw it. This is his version. The real nutshell of the type of work that you can accomplish on your own side, so that the relationship is floating. It is a ship, and it is going forward across the sea. And in a way, it has to do with kind of like what people would find in therapy. It was a recapitulation of what he was saying, like, more ancient cultures. We were talking about this last time. More ancient cultures, they had it built in of how to raise a complete individual. It was tried and true. Like, if my dad was a cobbler, I would learn the trade of making shoes, and when the time came, I'd take it over. And the role that the cobbler had in the village was very well defined. You know, I wasn't going to open a factory and go global with my shoes. It was like how it worked with everyone. They needed shoes, and they knew the position. That knowing your position and your station and the future vocation, all that stuff, for the majority of human history, was how people were raised, and it was rock solid. People really knew, you know, who they were in the context of their family and their culture, society, but it didn't change. It wasn't growing in that way. So the particular type of Dharma I get comes from Tibet, and Tibet is like this anomaly in a ways. I mean, it's changed now. But, you know, up until the last generation, its rules, its culture was still medieval. They still had that kind of stability and rigidity. You know, with it becomes this, you can't really evolve culturally rapidly. So we were saying, we gave up our stability and our, you know, security of identity unconsciously. It just happened that way. We're in this culture that has to go forward and move forward. So there's so many broken families. The family thing was, for many people, you know, oh, I had one parent, I missed the other one, you know, or it was I was back and forth between parents and things like that. The stability is for us to make. We have to recreate that type of lack of flakiness in our own psyches, so we can show up with as much love as we can muster. Like, love becomes this act of will. We're going to give the love to the other on purpose. It's not just because I love you, because we're in love.
Right.
We fall in love, and it's so easy to give love. But then it's like, okay, who's going to take out the garbage?
Yep.
While we're in love, it doesn't matter. I'll do it for you, darling. I'll do it for you forever.
Forever. It's interesting. I'm thinking how, and trying to draw the connection to sort of a more worldly dysfunction we have to the dysfunction we have in the family unit, like you're saying, like that lack of stability that is created or has been created through, you know, the last probably couple generations in the United States, and how that affects children growing up that then don't have that internal stability, so that can't come from a place of stable will towards other people because they haven't found that for themselves or been taught how to do that for
right.
themselves.
Which is so wonderfully that you started the series with self-love, because this intention to be loving, first you practice it on yourself.
Right.
You're the most closest example of the being who needs love.
Mm-hmm.
And the 6-in-1 was a way to get to that point. And, are you ready for the rundown?
Yeah, I'm ready for the rundown. If you're just joining us, this is Love in the 21st Century with Adam and Tamara. We are talking about love and family, from family of origin to the family of co-creation. And you can join the conversation, 895-1114, 895-1114. That number gets you right on the air. Otherwise, you can post something on the Facebook page, and I'll do my best to check it before the show is out. And I did want to, I wanted to share a story that came to mind when you're talking about, you know, family of origin, family of co-creation. I'd been working with some friends a few years ago, and we'd gotten to this place where, you know, we were all doing really good at first, you know, eating together, talking, working, things were great. And then at a certain point, there started to become this like inner tension dynamics where two people would be talking and then two other people wouldn't be talking. And so between the four of us, it just got to a point where you never saw more than a two-person conversation. It went from like group conversation, two-people conversation, and then no more eating together. And I remember like I felt like that was a pivotal shift. Like, oh, we're not eating together. That's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so upset. I was so upset at these guys. And I was like, I'm not going to be friends with them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was dating one of their good friends. So I didn't really feel like, even though that was an option, it would be a real painful option to be around these people and not be able to get along with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this aha moment when I was driving home one day where I was like, you know, even though I don't really like what these guys are doing right now, I still love them. And
mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, like my family. like I have those moments with my brothers and my parents where I'm just like, you know, I get so frustrated and angry, but it's never a question of like, am I not going to like you anymore? Well, you're my mom, you know, like you're my brother. Of course, you know, I just need that time to work through it for myself to realize we're two different people and that's okay. And we don't have to see things the same way. But it was a real big moment for me in friendships to realize, okay, like you can
do that.
You can overcome this, you know, imagined obstacle in your friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is it actually evolves into a deeper relationship, which is like family.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. In the Dharma, there's also this principle of awakening. You know, the Buddha demonstrated what an awakening being was like. And the wannabe, I want to be a Buddha, is a bodhisattva. So like, I want to be tending towards living in a more awake way. I'm a bodhisattva. But the bodhisattva doesn't attain enlightenment until all the beings are going to be able to attain it as well. All the beings are coming into nirvana. Like, you don't get nirvana sensation, bliss, just for oneself. It has to include everyone. No one is excluded from that. So that's like the really big heart. The really, really big heart. Then, in terms of like the individual dynamics, you know, some people, it's not gonna, we were talking about this before too, that it's like, I gotta say no. I have to actually make a little boundary here. Because it's gonna hurt me, you know, if I give this extra bit that you seem to be demanding. But that doesn't mean that you're out of the love. That doesn't mean that you're out of the really big heart. You know, that just doesn't go away. So we were talking practically, on the practical level, how to get from the family of origin or the lack thereof to the family of your co-creating. And I was saying this little nugget, the 6-in-1, was a big part of that for me, and something so valuable, I feel like I'd like to share.
Please do.
Okay. Fred said, Fred's, aka Fred, said that the function of the six and one is to release will from the propensities of obligation. And I'd be like, oh, what's that? Propensities of obligation is like, I want to behave in a certain way towards a beloved, and I find myself acting in a habitual way. The key one is like, oh my goodness, I sound like my mother, or I sound like my father. So if that's happening, then you've been, your willpower has been captured by a propensities of obligation. So the six in one is a way to negotiate one's propensities of obligation to voidness. How does it happen? Well, there's a little self-discipline involved. You're taking 20 to 40 minutes a day and hanging with a particular contemplation. The contemplation changes every day. There are 6 days, and on the 7th day, you rest. Ah. Then you pick it up again, go 3 weeks total. So it's 3 rounds of 6 contemplations. And that's the form that it takes. The inner working of it is actually amazingly simple. The 1st day contemplation is the my mother / myself contemplation. The 2nd day is the my father / myself contemplation. The 3rd is the my family of origin, myself contemplation, or my blood relations / myself contemplation. The 4th day is the my peer group, myself contemplation, especially the peer group that you had age 12, 13, 14, 15. Those kind of formative peer parent years. Peer parent is also like something in puberty. If we didn't get enough parenting from our parents, we get it from our peer group. The 5th is the my culture / myself contemplation. And the 6th is the my society / myself contemplation. These 6 formative relationships is how we get to a deeper understanding of the identity, of the experience of being an individual. It's like we learn so much. We learn peak in these relationships. And there's certain developmental stages as the child grows from a state of total dependence to a state of independence. And we were talking about what's family dysfunction. What's the definition of a dysfunctional family or a functional family? And the joke, my kind of like shorthand, is like, oh, you raise kids. You have competent adults who feel secure in themselves and can, you know, go forth into the world and make it a better place. Hopefully. That's like a functional family. One of the ideas, you know, there's so many different permutations of that, but that's like the real shorthand thing. So there's a huge spectrum of, you know, functional, dysfunctional. They overlap. But sure enough, we are born, and the human species is the most dependent for the longest time of any of the mammals. There's not any other mammal on the planet that has such a longer span of dependency on the adults. You know, I was still like 31 coming home to my folks. I got to get it together. Like, get away. Go away. Get back. We've done our bit. But the bond with the mother at the beginning obviously is primary. And there's certain developmental stages which are universal. Like when the three-year-old discovers that they can say no to mom. No. And they mean it, you know? And it's like the first time that that syllable has ever been spoken by anyone, anywhere. When you say it for the first time, it's like your own discovery. You've made it. And yet, it's a developmental stage. Every kid has that point where they get to the so-called terrible twos. Now it's more in the threes, where they're able to assert themselves in some small way and enter into the toddler phase, you know, where they have their own person. They're starting to make their own choices. And they're the most dangerous, you know, at that point. You gotta really, it's like, it kicks it into high gear again. Parenting is really a gas. I recommend it to all of you out there. But there's these phases and stages where you have to focus in really close and pay a lot of attention, a lot of support. The newborn is like that. Then the toddler. Then maybe the teenager. My teenage girls wouldn't agree.
I think you have something there, though. Definitely, there's definitely periods of time when you're wanting to pay closer attention in those teen years. I'm sure there's. I like to think that there was lots of things that my parents didn't know that I was up to, but according to my mother, she always knew what I was up to, and to the point where I tested her on that. I was like, "Yeah, like what about these times?" And she knew. I was like, "How did you know?"
But a good parent is like not. We know, but we're not letting them know that we know.
Exactly. I had no idea that she knew. I felt bad for her not knowing. And she was like, "Oh, I'm your mother. Of course I knew what you were up to. Could just look at you and tell you what you were up to." It's like, well, that's good. Good to know that I'm loved so closely.
But we skip ahead. The teen thing, the peer group, becomes the most important formative relationship. How do you fit? How do you feel like you're accepted? I mean, the first thing is the acceptance, you know, my mother, myself, my father, myself, my family, myself. You're feeling these at different stages in your life as you're growing older. Your identity goes to that extent. At the beginning, we're fully defined by mother. The infant makes no distinction between mother's needs, mother's moods, and your own. You know, initially it's chemically. Mom's giving you your nutrients and your support through your umbilical cord. What she's experiencing, the chemical she's putting her body through, whatever, is coming right through you. So you do have that oneness. We all get to start life experiencing that. But then step by step, we apparently step into this wonderful independence, which is illusory. Because like the rainbows on the July the 4th, it's glorious interdependence. We're so causally connected with absolutely everyone and everything that we're saying the best way to love yourself is to recognize that there actually is no self.
Indeed. You're just tuning in, Love in the 21st Century. We did have a caller that I wasn't able to get to in time, so if you want to call back, our number's 895-1114. I think there's a couple more of the six, right? Did we make it?
We made it all the way through. Oh, wow. We're all the way up to society, myself, on the sixth day, and then on the seventh day, you rest. Just let it all go. And as a discipline, it's really very strongly suggested you're able to do a full 3 weeks commitment. Just 20, 40 minutes that you set aside as sacred, you know, for yourself. No screens, no interruptions. Make a space for the depth of the reflection on that topic, you know, as it changes day by day. And there'll be resistance, you know, you'll get to that relationship that I have the hardest thing with, and it's like, maybe I don't need to do it today. That's the day to do it, you know, when you get that natural pull and resistance away from. Because as you go through, you start to find a deeper and deeper forgiveness, a deeper and deeper understanding of the karmic connection, the causal connections that brought that relationship about, and how to really integrate all the good qualities. You know, a lot of times people are working because, I have so much assimilation from this individual in this relationship, or I have such a reaction away. That's exactly what I don't want to do. So we push it away. Both of those need to be negotiated.
I have some questions to dive into after we hear from our caller. Mona, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Mona.
Hi. Thank you for you've given just a lot of great wisdom and insight. I have a fault of paying attention to detail. I just appreciate you being here for me. I'm going through a huge spiritual transformation at this point in time.
Wow, wonderful. Good
and
for
I'm
you.
And I'm very, very grateful. And I can't cover the 7 points. Well, you said six, but, you know, I've kind of been going in and out from my individual experience. But just, I don't know what you're talking about, motherly love and bond, because mm-hmm. I come from a place where I never had that.
Sure.
And I'm trying to understand fully what you're talking about, but
yeah.
I don't have that connection
mm-hmm.
you're associating the understanding with.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just hopeful that you could interpret or help me understand.
Sure. Yeah, it's the...
I understand the maternal and the planet and Mother Earth and vicariously. I can touch on some of the points. I've lived my life vicariously through others, meeting every need I ever got, and peer pressure, humongous, because
right.
you seek every need you never had.
Yeah.
And I mean, just so much wisdom in everything you've said.
Awesome.
You know, I've just got some stumbling blocks I'm trying to get over to
have
full comprehension.
So there's this other, I keep wanting to get around to read this book, but there's a book called The Spiritual Advantages of a Difficult Childhood.
No, I don't need all that. No, I've done all that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't need that. I was just trying to touch out from one soul to another.
Gotcha. I feel you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mona.
And no, I appreciate all the gifts you've given me. I just was just trying to maybe bring to light some defects some individuals might have
mm-hmm.
that so they can't relate quite to the situation. That's all. One of my faults is paying attention to detail because I'm very intense. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. I shouldn't have wasted your time.
No apologies.
No problem.
We appreciate your call, and you are hitting the target. That's exactly what my question to Adam was going to be after you had your chance to talk, is what about when people have resistance towards or do not relate to these sort of deeper concepts that they're meditating on? Like when we're talking about the meditation with the peer group, and he specifically brought up that 12 to 15-year-old range, I remember feeling really extremely ostracized and not having any assimilation to my teens. And like, if I think about now my peers, it's a lot different. But that period of time is really challenging for me to think of, especially in relation to my peers. And so that's what I'm hoping that Adam's going to shine a little bit of light on. So
absolutely, because I just want to share with you.
Yeah.
I'm 55 years old. I consider myself in preschool or less than most of the time because just, you know, I just was in hibernation for a long time and didn't learn, refused to learn, was defiant, stubborn, rebellious.
Now you know, you're waking up.
Now
you're waking up.
To not have our souls be bought or sold.
Mm.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Mona, and we appreciate the insights that you have shared.
Keep on keeping on.
Thank you so much for being on the air, man. I appreciate it.
Yes. Talk to you soon.
So the response can be, I don't have any experience of that. You know, I don't know. That not knowing becomes the focus. We have to be able to hold that space and lean into that that potentially painful examination, that painful reconnection. And along those lines, I was just remembering, like, the fantastic tool of Vipassana meditation. This is insight meditation. And I first encountered this when I was practicing Zen. You sit meditation, and the legs start hurting. And my very first Chan master was from China, very strong discipline, you know, and he's like, if your legs start hurting, it's not that they're going to be damaged, but you have a chance to work with your reaction to the pain on an inner level. When I feel the pain, it's like, ah, I want it to go away. I'm pissed at my body hurting. That makes it hurt worse. But in the meditation, you find a space where, oh, that's the pain. That's the actual physical sensation. This is my mind's thoughts about that pain. This is how I'm formulating, I'm going to, you know, combat that pain. All of that extra bit, if I relax around all of that, then I'm just with what's happening, and the pain changes, the sensation changes wonderfully. So that is kind of a window into what can happen as the discipline deepens of doing the six and one, where those areas which are emotionally painful, we're more interested in our reaction to that than the storyline about it. And bit by bit, week by week, you go deeper, you become more and more freed up in your capacity to love the other, to love yourself more completely, more genuinely. That was what Fritz was wanting for me, and I practiced it with myself for years. It took years. Then bit by bit, it's like, oh, I saw the possibility for a relationship that could go into a partnership. And we got there by vows. And then bit by bit, step by step, we make a commitment to each other. I'm working on my side. I'm working on my, how the six and one is forming, reforming within me. So I can show up cleaner and clearer, you know, on the line. And with that, there's the possibility of happy families.
Helping to spread the love through your family to more families, hopefully. Thank you for tuning in tonight to 90.1 FM. Ecotopia is up next. Thank you, Adam, for sharing your insights, as always. And thank you, Mona, for your phone call. We always appreciate hearing insights from the outside. So stay tuned for tonight for Ecotopia, and we'll be back next Tuesday at 5 o'clock starting our Love and Relationship 5-week series.
Billions of our tax dollars have already been wasted on the fantasy that America can wall itself off from the people of Mexico and Central America. It's a fool's errand, but the fools of the Republican right wing, Trump, Cruz, Rubio, and others, want to throw many more billions at a higher, longer, and meaner barrier. They claim it will save us Anglos from being swarmed by brown-skinned migrants, or, as the venomous Ted Cruz snidely labeled our southern neighbors, undocumented Democrats. Of course, Ted himself migrated into our country from Canada, and he's turned out to be such a political pest that his very presence here argues for erecting a wall on our northern border. He and the rest of the wall builders are xenophobic political opportunists who know nothing about the long common bond that families on both sides of the Rio Grande have had for generations. They should listen to border residents like John Ferguson, mayor of Presidio, Texas, right across the border from Ojinaga, Mexico. A high